you were also active at this time in the professional societies.
Yes.
A little bit later, you were AICH, about 5 years after you went, became vice president, but you were on the World Petroleum Congress starting in 55, I think.
Right.
And you organized an ACS Petroleum Division Symposium in 55. So I'm looking at these general activities within your professional societies as well.
This job as vice president of engineering and formerly a vice president of and associate director of research of Gulf Research. And later, in 1960, I became executive technical advisor, and also, a little bit later, in 1962, I guess, director of planning and economics. All these jobs put me in a position of some technical responsibility in the Gulf organization at a reasonably high level, and gave me a platform from which to participate in professional society activities. So yes, the things you mentioned I did do. I was active in AICHE, went through the directorship and vice president, president, all that. And ACS, I did do the Petroleum Research Division. I was a member of the organizing committee which put on the petroleum congresses. That was separate from ACS. ACS involved this chemical, what did they call the thing? It was the recipient of the profits of Universal Oil Products Company, as it turned out.
Oh yes, Petroleum Research Fund.
Petroleum Research Fund, exactly. By a complicated series of maneuvers, it ended up that, for a period, the American Chemical Society owned UOP. That's another whole story. I don't pretend to understand it all. But that made a considerable amount of money available for petroleum research. And the ACS set up this committee to allocate the funds, and I was on that for a while. But I was also very active, particularly in the 60 to 64 period in the API, and I mentioned earlier that particularly in the so-called smoke and fumes area, the air pollution reduction area, they had a committee called the Smoke and Fumes Committee of all things, and it was not ideal from a public relations standpoint. We later changed the name of it, but it was responsible for API's considerable efforts in trying to elucidate the mechanism of Los Angeles smog. And some of the research they sponsored was absolutely basic to the understanding that that smog situation out there is this complicated chemistry of hydrocarbons and ozone and smoke, as well as the things that were conventionally had the finger pointed at. And I think we came to an understanding of some of the high level atmospheric, really high level chemistry that was involved in the thing, and the fact that it wasn't the refineries that were spewing out most of the smog, but it was the automobiles, and they were the culprits. And sure, we had a relationship to that, but it was, I think the contribution of that effort was to get the finger of scorn pointed a bit away from the refineries per se and the chemical plants, and pointed toward the real culprits, the automobiles. So I was quite active in API circles at that time as well.
That's sort of a two-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, as you said, you're making what the automobiles are using.
Well, we were going to get it one way or another, no question.
You had a number of you've written, we were mentioning AICHE, and in the 75th anniversary volume, you wrote a little bit about your year as president. It looked like a very exciting time.
It sure was. I enjoyed that year. It's been a long time now. When was that? 1960.
Yeah.
Jeez. That was exciting at the time. I forget a lot, of course, but it was a good time. And I got a lot out of the AICHE experience, a lot of contacts that I value highly and did over the years. It's part of why I'm so much a chemical engineer through and through, because of my very high regard for the people I know in the profession.
What were your contacts when you reached this level? What were your contacts with your counterparts in other companies?
Well, there were several. A lot of them were through the professional societies. That was one of the advantages of active participation, both in API and AICHE and ACS. You did get to see on a personal, professional basis some of your other counterparts, as you say. There were, continuing even after the war, a number of cooperative efforts. Gulf entered into a cooperative venture for hydrogen desulfurization with Shell that continued over several years and was beneficial to everybody. And there were some other continuing cooperative things from time to time. But I would guess a real answer, the best answer to your question is through the professional society connections.
There was no organization of such that research directors or whatever it might be that
there was, but I wasn't a member of it. There was an organization of research directors, but before I reached the level at which I would have qualified for membership in that, I had departed the research and development scene per se. And therefore I didn't participate in that.
You still had, after you became vice president, in that period from 55 to 60, you still had a number of patents, 4 or 5, I guess. Was that still left over from earlier work, or were you still involved in some way that patents were coming out in your name?
Mostly earlier work, but frankly I'd forgotten there were any in that period, but it was mostly earlier work.
Okay. What does it mean to become executive technical advisor?
Well, it means that I worked myself out of a job as vice president of engineering, and the original concept that Mr. Whiteford had that I explained a little while ago had been pretty well realized, and we had decentralized the engineering to the refineries, and the need for a centralized engineering group was considerably less than it was, and such as there was, we mostly Mr. Whiteford, decided it was better located closer to the refinery operating, and which by that time was largely in Houston. So that transfer was gradually made, and my job was somewhat eliminated. So they really were looking for something for me to do, and they appointed me executive technical advisor. And I didn't have any more idea what those words meant when I took the job than they did, which I don't think was very much, except that it sounded good and it gave me a platform from which to be active in other things, like the API, for example. And it was a wonderful experience that Mr. Whiteford gave me as part of the preparation for this job. He sent me on a round-the-world tour of Gulf's facilities to Europe and to the Philippines and to Japan and Korea and every place except South America. I never got to South America, but all the other places. Part of his organizational concept was to have area representatives in the principal areas to get Gulf's nose in the tent, as it were, in for new businesses and opportunities. And we had a particularly active area representative in Rome and in Spain and in Japan and the Philippines. And part of my world tour was visiting with each of these guys and spending a little time with them and just learning about the business. And it was a wonderful, wonderful way to learn about Gulf's worldwide business. And from time to time, I'd get some special assignment that came along. And then in 1962, they made me also director of planning and economics, which was the planning group, corporate planning group, which had a lot to do with Gulf's efforts to kind of coordinate things. And again, part of the fight for reorganization of the company, which was major and drastic and traumatic. He was quite a man. He was a very, he was a dynamic person who, I've often said, influenced everybody he came in contact with, for better or worse, for good or ill. And it wasn't always one or the other. I mean, there were things he did that I very strongly disagreed with and disapproved of and decried, deplored. But there were other things that were great, and he made Gulf. He made Gulf an international company. It had been a regional company and a family company, except for Kuwait, and he took that basis and made it into a truly international company, at least in part through these area representatives. So that was really what was going on there. And
were you given any specific charge when you were in 62 with in terms of planning and economics?
No, except to do a better job than we've been doing. Again, it had been a pretty good job, and we had some able people, but it didn't quite have the focus that we were trying to give it, and I guess I was able to come in and give it a certain amount of focus.
What specifically, is there anything specific in that two-year period before you went to London that you accomplished?
No, not as director of planning and economics. We had very able people, and to a considerable extent it was a learning experience for me. I was learning the economics planning side of the business, and I learned a great deal more than I put into it, I can assure you of that. During that period, not as director of planning economics, but as a special assignment as executive technical advisor, I had an experience which turned out to be most rewarding. I was chairman, Mr. Wright had appointed me chairman of a team of three people, a production man and a financial man, to go to the Gulf Canada, British American Oil Company. And as a team of, as it were, outside consultants, examine that company from stem to gudgeon and see what needed to be done to improve its operation. Mr. Whiteford had served as chairman or president and CEO of British American before he came to the Gulf job, and particularly from his standpoint, he didn't think it was doing as well as it ought to be. And some of his successors had turned in what he regarded as disappointing results, and he wasn't at all happy. So you go up there and see what's wrong with that outfit and tell them what ought to do. So for about 6 months, this team traveled all over Canada and interviewed a hundred people in the Gulf, what later became the Gulf Canada organization, the British American organization. Evaluated people and tried to figure out things that were, could be done better and whatnot, and came back and made some basic recommendations to Mr. Weisswood as to some personnel changes, some of which were made, and some changes in practices, some of which were done. Among the recommendations which were made over my objection and really behind my back, we got pretty well acquainted with the Gulf Canada British American people, and I got along pretty well with them, and we were, in spite of the fact that we were designated, we were called up there behind our backs, the three wise men, and therefore subject to a certain amount of snide remarks and a certain amount of resistance, as you might imagine. What are these guys doing here? Nevertheless, we got along pretty well, and I developed a high regard for a lot of the people. And the production member of my team, who was a guy who had just retired, as a matter of fact, from the production department, went privately to Whiteford and said, "You ought to put McAfee up there to run that show." Well, I didn't think it was a good idea, particularly to have a member of the team there, and when the body was brought up, I told Mr. Whiteford so, and he agreed. So we had some other changes instead, and put a Canadian in charge. And that was a time when Mr. Whiteford sent me to London to be Senior Vice President of Gulf Eastern and Senior Vice President of Gulf Oil, and to be the coordinator of Gulf's operations in Europe and Africa and the Middle East. Well, that was a new job, which had not been defined before, and neither I nor anyone knew really what it was supposed to be. And it turned out to be an impossible job, in a sense, because I was, it says here, responsible for coordinating the activities of these various departments, which were autonomous. They had officers in London, the refining department, the marketing department, the supply department, the supply and crude oil department, the production department, exploration, finance. They all answered to their bosses in their respective functional fields in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. But this fellow who'd been appointed coordinator was supposed to make them work together and make things come out even. Geraldine, you're home, love.
I am. I'm sorry to be late. You know, I had to detour around the long way home.
Good Lord, where have you been? You were supposed to go to the grocery store.
Grocery store.
I'll tell you what, Geraldine. We're, as you might well imagine, we've been discussing my favorite subject, namely me.
Well, I can't imagine the one more. I hope the thing's off.
No, that's all right. This is important.
It's a great ego trip.
Well, it is. It's a wonderful opportunity to say some, and to recollect some things. So I'm having a bowl.
I'm sure.
But we're
about through.
We're getting hungry.
Oh, well, sure. It's time for a break.
So why don't we carry on here for another 15 minutes or so? And if you'd be so good as to call the Yacht Club, tell them we'll come down shortly and have a bite of lunch with them.
All right.
Okay?
All right. I'll be ready in 10 minutes, and if you're ready in 15, that's fine.
Okay. That'll be fine. That all right with you?
That's fine.
So this coordinator guy was supposed to pull these things together. He had no authority over any of these fellows, but he had the responsibility of making them work together. And this, if there was ever a test of diplomacy, well, that was it. And it was, as I say, a basically impossible job. But somehow we managed it, and I had a wonderful experience as part of that job. It came with the territory. I was Gulf's representative on the board of directors of the Kuwait Oil Company, which was our joint operating company with BP for Kuwait. And I was Gulf's representative on the Iranian Consortium, which was the consortium of seven major oil companies and a bunch of independents for Iran after Mossadegh. And speaking of opportunities, to have contacts with opposite numbers. That was a marvelous such opportunity, because each of the representatives, each of the companies in the consortium, had a man in London, a fairly senior level, who was on that consortium, in the consortium, and each spoke for his company. But they had a complicated bunch of rules, like a kind of a mini United Nations, and each company had a vote depending on its ownership, and it took a certain number of ownership shares to take certain actions and so forth. And none of these guys had, including me, had enough authority to make very many decisions on his own. So most of the things that came up had to be referred back to the head office to get the party line. And so there was a lot of back and forth, and a lot of meetings, and a lot of shenanigans. But it, not shenanigans in a shitty sense, but I mean a lot of red tape and a lot of doing. It also involved going out to Iran every year for an annual tour. And 1 6 months we would go to Iran, and the next 6 months the Iranians would come to London and or Holland. Shell was a big factor in it. They had a big part of the ownership. And so we had a lot of contact with the Iranians in that way. I got to see some of Iran and so forth. But that was an interesting part of that coordinating job, which turned out to be a fascinating thing. We were there only 3 years, which was really just long enough to begin to learn the ropes, and we were really beginning to feel at home, and they yanked me out and put me in Canada. But it was a great 3 years, and I was grateful for it. And actually, you know, the round-the-world trip that Mr. Whiteford had sent me on and the contacts I'd made were very useful in that regard.
Did you have any inkling at that time, especially being in Iran and relationship with Kuwait, did you have any inkling of what was coming in the future?
Well, yes and no. OPEC was beginning to rattle its sword by that time. They were coming into their own. Just coming into their own. I was one of the experts who confidently predicted that OPEC would not last a year, that it would fall apart, that the Arabs could not possibly work together well enough to make it work. And therefore, I was confident that this was a passing fancy that would go away. Well, I had made some mistakes in my day, but none worse than that. And yes, the beginnings of OPEC's encroachment into the province of the oil companies was evident. And there were, I forget how it went, but first there was a disallowance of royalties as a tax, and then wanting a higher than 50% sharing of the profits, and then, oh, I forget how all these steps took, but each one the Iranians were taking a bigger bite. And, oh, not the Iranians, I mean the whole Arab, the whole OPEC countries. And eventually they took the rest of it.
Were your views on OPEC shared by others at that time too? Was that the general feeling?
Yes, I think it was. That was conventional wisdom. These guys can't work together. They never have, never will. Well, they did. They had done a good job of it.
Why were you removed? Why were you sent to Canada? You had already had that connection before.
I asked that question of myself at the time and subsequently. And I'm not real sure what the answer was. I was doing well. I got along with my other industry people. I thought we were bringing things along pretty well, and I was, again, I thought, this is a wonderful job. This is, I can finish my career right here and be perfectly happy. And so I don't really know, except that, again, Whiteford decided that the time had come, and it was Whiteford, to make some personnel moves. And the man that we had put in as the Canadian, as head of the company, was reaching retirement age. And I think he concluded that there had been enough time since the task force, the three wise men, mm-hmm. that I could go in as a viable leader. And so he sent me there as, go ahead and change if you like.
Oh, I have to get another tape out too. So I don't do what I did once, which is to tape over a side I had already.
Oh, that could be embarrassing.
Yes.